The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see...
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Norman Finkelstein is a controversial figure on the left. However, while Finkelstein is famous for his books about the Israel-Palestine conflict, we don't discuss that topic at all, but instead discuss a book he's working on, entitled On Academic Freedom. Finkelstein has taught political theory for years. He's a former Maoist, but perhaps surprisingly, he's become an admirer of John Stuart Mill. It's Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast and the publisher of Zero Books. Thanks should go out to members of the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to Inside Zero Books, which sometimes consists of an unedited or full-length interview. It's the second podcast we do each week, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left. This week, the Inside Zero Books podcast will feature the second half of this conversation with Norman Finkelstein, wherein we discuss his former Maoism, how he thinks Obama was overrated, and Bertrand Russell. I should also take a moment to ask you to stop by the Zero Books website and maybe purchase a book on critical theory. The title I'd most recommend is Uncertain Futures, by Edmund Berger. Berger explains how understanding Marxist theory of value can help us understand the rise of the far right. Also of interest would be Alfie Bound's interview with Sreco Horvat, I believe that's how you say it, and Stephen Lee Nash's deconstruction of the 80s film Dirty Dancing and his book Deconstructing Dirty Dancing. The music you're listening to is a bit of vaporwave from St. Pepsi called Private Caller. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Norman Finkelstein and I discuss his book on academic freedom. Norman Finkelstein received his doctorate in 1988 from the Department of Politics at Princeton University. He is a prominent left thinker and a critic of Israel. He's also the author of books such as What Gandhi Says About Nonviolence, Resistance, and Courage, The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, and Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. Today we're going to be talking about academic freedom. Norman Finkelstein, thank you for taking the time to be on the Zero Books podcast.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so your latest book is entitled on...
It's not quite finished yet.
Yeah,
it's,
but...
You saw the draft.
Yeah, I saw a draft of the first three chapters, and to me... It looks great, so I'm sure it's going to be coming out. It's entitled On Academic Freedom, and that subject, perhaps to our misfortune, is particularly significant these days in the current climate. We're living in a time when it seems like neither the left nor the right is concerned or very consistent about academic freedom, and I'm wondering if the current climate was a major factor that motivated you to write this book or to begin writing it. Or whether maybe your own personal history in academia was behind you, the writing of your book.
Well, first of all, I'd like to not so much correct you as to give my own sense of what's happening. I don't think it's correct to say the left. I don't want to speak about the right because I have no real knowledge of it. I don't think it's correct to say that the left is not concerned about academic freedom. I think there have been two distinct trajectories. I really wouldn't call them traditions. They're just distinct trajectories, one of which says no free speech for fascists, and that has a long history. and parts of it, I suppose, not suppose, parts of it, I can understand, although I think it it ends up tying oneself in knots intellectually. It ends up being hypocritical and impasse and producing all sorts of, I think, political disasters. However, I understand that tradition, and I, to some extent, I sympathize with it. And there's the other tradition, which in my younger years I found loathsome. It's basically the First Amendment fundamentalist tradition of going back in the modern world, going back to John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, the essence of which is that we're all fallible creatures, nobody has a monopoly on truth, and that the only way to acquire truth is, and I'm quoting Mill, a standing invitation to the world to prove us wrong. Unless we are willing to let anybody contradict our opinions, we have no basis for assuming what we think to be true actually is true. And that, in the U.S. context, that's been the basic position of left liberal organizations like the ACLU. And I mean, now, since probably since the 1980s, that was the position I adopted after reading Mill, pondering his arguments, not really being able to see where they are flawed. And I still don't think, at least the parts of his essay dealing with liberty of speech, I don't think there is a compelling answer to them. That's the tradition. So I wouldn't say the left is not concerned with liberty of speech or academic freedom. I think they have a different understanding of it. And going back to the no free speech for fascists and its current form is all these variations of political correctness, safe spaces, and so forth, with which I strongly disagree. As to my impetus for writing the book, it was really a kind of, I wanted to put my own situation to the test. I was denied tenure a decade ago, this coming June, and I've never been able to find employment, and so I've been unemployed and will be unemployed till I depart to greener pastures. So I wanted to look at what is academic freedom and whether I would pass muster or whether I deservedly was denied it and also denied the right to teach.
The first chapter focuses quite a lot on your own story, which is something you wanted to revise. You told me in the...
I'm going to get rid of it. I don't want to talk about myself.
Okay. Well, then I won't ask you questions about that. You know what? I'm going to follow up on the first half of my first question just a little bit. It seems to me that the logic of no-platforming fascists has driven the left in recent years to some absurd positions where even people who are usually taken to be on the left are no-platformed for having the wrong opinion about this or that issue, usually around transgender issues, but it could be for a variety of heresies. My thought is that just is a natural outgrowth of the original position.
I don't think that's the main danger. I think the main danger is the no platform for fascists when it, in its most manifest forms, is the Annapolis and more recently at Middlebury College, the Charles Murray cases. But I think it's more I'm not sure if pernicious or sinister, let's just call it its more problematic forms, is the pervasiveness of this whole culture of political correctness, safe spaces, and so forth, which is the current version of what constitutes a fascist, today a fascist, aside from, as I said, the more manifest forms, whether it's Yiannopoulos or Murray or Bannon. It takes the form of Islamophobic, homophobic, xenophobic, all these phobias that have to be silenced. So I don't think the main problem is fascism per se, whatever it is, but the main problem is this kind of policing of what is tolerable speech on the basis of some claims to enlightenment about what's best for people and what will hurt them.
Yeah, well, do you think that it's that this political correctness?
I should add that it's slightly different in the past, because in the past the issue was fascists are these sinister characters who will, if able to acquire power, are going to cause or wreak huge damage. Nowadays, it's sort of like these people shouldn't be allowed to speak, not so much because they might cause huge damage if they ever gained power, as it is they shouldn't be allowed to speak because they hurt my feelings, which is slightly, which is different, but still I think its basis is in this notion that in the olden days, it used to be that we know the truth, we are the Marxist-Leninists, we have a monopoly on truth, and anyone who disagrees with us is either a bourgeois or a petty bourgeois or a fascist, which was no different than a bourgeois for a lot of the left. And so there was this notion of we have a monopoly on the truth. We know what's best for... wait, hold on.
No problem.
We know what's best for humankind, and anyone who disagrees with us, as I say, bourgeois, petty bourgeois, and so forth. Nowadays, it's the same kind of mindset that we know what's good for humankind. We're enlightened, we're progressive, and everything that's, everyone who disagrees with us is some sort of reactionary, and for the betterment of humankind, they ought to be, silenced at any rate on a college campus.
The fundamental assumption behind moves to no platform or to limit speech is that someone has a monopoly on the truth.
Yes, I think that's correct.
And so that assumption is counter to a different tradition which views, I don't know, community discussion as a ongoing search for truth without anyone necessarily arriving at a final position.
There's obviously a recognition of human fallibility, or as Mill says, he refers to the presumption of infallibility by those who want to silence others. He says any silencing of opinion is a presumption of infallibility. And he says the issue arises, even if you have certitude about your beliefs, let's say you're 100% certain what you believe to be true is true, that still doesn't give you the right, as Mill puts it, to silence others. If others aren't as certain as you, then why shouldn't they have the right to hear all sides and decide for themselves? So Mills says, the presumption of infallibility is deciding questions for others. If you want to maintain 100% certainty, well, that's obviously your right, though it's impossible that you could be 100% certain. But if you want to maintain your certainty, that's certainly your right. However, that doesn't give you the right to decide the question for others. If you believe that Yiannopoulos is a fascist, or Murray is a fascist, or Bannon is a fascist, well, that's your right. But if others haven't reached that opinion, what gives you the right to silence them hearing the other side and deciding for themselves?
So in the back, I basically agree with what you're saying. So it's to keep the conversations going, I'm going to take the devil's advocate position.
Mm-hmm. I want to just add before you pose your question that there are two aspects. Mill makes two arguments, or several arguments, but the main forms they take are, number one, you can never be certain that what you believe to be true is true because we're fallible creatures. But there's a second part to his argument, and that is, even if what you think is true, there are definite benefits to be gained, to be derived from letting other people speak, because they give you a clearer understanding of your own truth. The collision of truth with a falsity helps illuminate the essence of your truth. It's only when you have to defend your beliefs against contrary opinions or against naysayers that the essence of your belief comes out. Otherwise, Mill says, the only part of your belief that remains, he says, is the husk and the shell, the outer or superficial, veneer of your belief. To really understand even your own belief, it requires a collision with those who disagree with you. So even if it were true, even for the sake of argument, even if it were true that what you believe to be true actually is true, to really understand even your own argument, it needs to be constantly tested and challenged by dissenting opinions.
Right. Okay, so here's what I was going to ask you. And this is maybe a little tricky, so bear with me. But there's this idea that what holds cultures together, what holds communities together, are certain kinds of beliefs which remain untested. Maybe their religious convictions, maybe their ideological convictions. But for the sake of community cohesion, these ideas are sacrosanct and they're not investigated. And I would say that this notion is, there's a parallel to it in the realm of psychology rather than sociology, where a great deal of what allows us to operate in the world are some unconscious assumptions or unconscious perceptions. Someone like Heidegger would talk about, the world that was ready to hand and the tool that went unquestioned until it stopped functioning. And so my question for you is, do you think that there are some beliefs which serve a utilitarian function, which we might not question, or which when we do question, it becomes dangerous because those beliefs are fundamental to the maintenance of a certain kind of society?
Well, first of all, you can start with the premise that in Mill's term, and now I'm quoting Mill, in the opinion not of bad men, but the best of men, nothing which is contrary to truth is useful. Now, what you seem to be suggesting is that there may be things that are not true, but are useful. And I would say that you'd have to demonstrate that. I think the normal assumption is a lie is not useful. If you want to make the argument that a lie or an untruth is useful, then it seems to me the burden of proof is on you, because the commonplace assumption is the one that Mill makes: nothing which is contrary to truth is useful. And if you like, you can go to YouTube and you'll see, I guess, a 3-minute YouTube interview with Bertrand Russell on religion. And the same point comes up. He says, I've investigated religion. I don't find it to be what's said about it. I've looked at the propositions of Christianity. I can't find them to be true. And if they're not true, they can't be useful. So the first response to you would be, I think the burden of proof is on you to show how something which is, to put it boldly, something which is a lie would nonetheless be useful. The second burden, I think, on you is there's a difference between what one might call, there's what we call a white lie, but then there's also what you might call an innocuous lie. Now, what you seem to be saying is that there are certain lies which are either innocuous or actually lies that serve some positive end. They help keep a community together. They are, as it were, some of the sinews of a community. However, I think you would have to demonstrate, even if that were true, that there are these, so to speak, lies that help keep the community cohesive. You still have to demonstrate, in order to make your case, you'd have to demonstrate they don't do any harm to anyone. There are, you know, let's say during our civil rights movement, the South, white Southerners kept making the case that we want to keep our Southern way of life. And they considered the Southern way of life to be either a positive thing or innocuous. We like fried chicken. We like going on picnics, whatever the Southern way of life comprised. But obviously, there were aspects to the Southern way of life that were causing huge pain, torment, anguish to some of the constituents of that community. So it may seem like a harmless thing, these lies. They maintain the Southern way of life, but beneath the Southern way of life, there are members of that community which are suffering from it. And so you would have to demonstrate to me that these either innocuous lies or in your argument, actually positive lies, you'd have to show me that they're not harming anyone. I would want to see which lies you have in mind and whether there's nobody who is suffering by virtue of those lies.
Would I need to show that it was that these lies weren't harming anyone, or would I need to show that if you do some sort of moral calculus, removing those lies would end up hurting more people than keeping them? In other words, if I could relegate the harm to a small minority and maintain the health and happiness of the majority.
I think those are very problematic notions. I mean, by those sorts of notions, you can begin to justify a forms of discrimination in all sorts of ways. The current position of Israelis who acknowledge what happened in terms of the displacement or dispossession of the indigenous population, their view is that creating a Jewish state was a higher good. That yes, people suffered, but the end justified that suffering, this glorious high-tech Western democratic Jewish state. And then there's the old Stalinist standbys. If you want to make an omelet, you have to break eggs. If you want to sell a tree, chips must fly. Chips will fly. And so the chips are that minority. Well, you get the idea. So again, if you look at history, you have a very heavy burden of proof that it's okay to sacrifice a minority if this lie enables the majority, to even supermajority, to live a thriving existence. I think that's a very heavy burden.
I agree with you. It's just it's one that I think I hear on the right, actually, these days. There's a fellow who's becoming somewhat well-known named Jordan Peterson, who's defending traditional gender roles based on that argument, that it may not be entirely true that these gender roles can be justified, or that they are essential, but that they are necessary conditions for the maintenance of our current society, and that you muck about with them at your own peril, and that that you know you are risking chaos. And I wonder, despite the fact that I agree with everything you've said so far, I feel as though I agree with it without knowing the truth of it yet. So I want to push on it a little more, because if it is the case that in our efforts to bring justice and equality, we end up undermining a system which is maintaining some sort of general order and create real chaos and mass suffering, can we justify our own quest for truth at that point? I mean, if we stay at the level of utility and you know, hedonistic ethics, can we ultimately justify our questing after truth and risk, take the risk of mass suffering in the name of the truth?
Well, there are just a large number of assumptions packed into these questions, this question of yours. First of all, the changing of sex roles in our society and all sorts of other kindred movements, they didn't result from some sort of battle of ideas. These were fundamental social political processes which, frankly, they can't be reversed. Women entered the workforce, and that set in train a large number of changes in our society. It wasn't in its origins an ideological battle. Once women entered the workforce, there were significant changes in family structure and family expectations. And then there were desires to enter all realms of the workforce. And changes started to unfold. And whatever this person might wish, they are as likely to be, this person Peterson, they are as likely to be reversed as the restoration of the pre-antebellum South, the restoration of slavery. Now, slavery had its own element of, it was one of the pillars of stability in the South, but historical forces were unleashed. They climaxed in the Civil War, and in the course of the Civil War, slavery was abolished. At least chattel slavery was abolished, and you're not going to reverse that. It was not an accident. Mill's other classic essay is The Subjection of Women, and he compared the condition of women to slavery. And he said in some respects, the condition of women was worse than slavery, because he said there was at least an assumption that the slave master had no rights of intimacy with the slave, whereas a husband has all rights of intimacy with a woman. The point being that once slavery, chattel slavery, was eliminated, then it was going to almost follow, as B follows from A, that the subjection of women would be eliminated. And Mill was obviously quite ahead of his time, and not only in his projections, but also his arguments, if you read the essay. But once it happened, and it basically happens in the 1960s, once it happened, or at least the second phase, the first phase was women acquiring the right to vote, and then it, in the 1960s, it then extended to the workplace, social life, and so forth. Once that happened, you can't reverse it any more than you can restore slavery. So I think these sorts of questions are, they're interesting topics for philosophy seminars, but they have no connection with the real world.
Well, just to clarify, in the case of Jordan Peterson, he wasn't in any way advocating that women shouldn't be in the workplace. His whole battle is about whether or not there are two genders, or whether or not gender fluidity is justified as an idea. He is worried about being commanded to use certain pronouns or to use people's preferred pronouns.
Those are completely separate questions, I think.
Yeah, they are. That's why I'm bringing it up.
Those sorts of questions belong to the domain of evolutionary biology and related fields. I don't think they have much. They aren't, whether or not there are two, I don't like the word genders, whether or not there are two sexes, and this notion of gender fluidity, I'm very skeptical of those notions. I don't think humanity would have survived were we as sexually fluid as is now claimed. It's a very, the struggle to survive is a very tough one. Human beings are very fragile creatures, and I don't think they would have survived very long if we didn't feel the compulsion to reproduce with all that entails for sexual identities. So I'm pretty skeptical of those notions. I think there is a kind of fetish that's developed in the academic left, in particular with notions like transgenders, transgender people, which probably constitute 0.00000000001% of humanity, and the kind of obsessiveness that's now now emerged on this, I find really kind of bizarre. Of course, you want to protect the rights of everybody, but it seems to me people who are dyslexic, autistic, who suffer from physical disabilities, that they don't get nearly the kind of attention that people who probably, constitutes an infinitesimally tiny percentage of humanity. And what accounts for this obsessiveness? It's an academic left that's become completely detached from the real life struggles of real life people, and probably is one of the reasons why Donald Trump won.
Well, my point in bringing up Peterson in that example, I mean, that was merely an example, and the problem with that example is it's a swamp, and we could, you know, wade into it for a long time. But my point was to say that Peterson, and he's a Jungian, wants to hold on to, and specifically gender, as we understand it, regardless of whatever the truth about gender might be, precisely for the kinds of reasons you gave, because having a notion of sexual difference in the way that we do facilitates reproduction and not the maintenance of particular social roles, but the maintenance of, I mean, I guess to some degree, particular social roles like the family and child rearing and things like that are maintained by having this notion of sexual difference, even if there's some fluidity in what women can do.
As I said, there's a very heavy burden to then justify the victims of this social setup based on a lie.
Right.
You'd have to demonstrate that somehow the general good outweighs the suffering of, in this case, one half of humankind. And that's a very tough case to make.
Right. Well, let's move on from that. I mean, we could go back and forth on this for a while still, but I don't think it would get us anywhere, specifically because I agree with you on, you know, fundamentally. So I don't want to keep taking the side I don't agree with. So to what extent do you think – I'm going to go back to my questions on my list here. To what extent do you think that conservative complaints about political correctness today have merit?
Well, they have merit in – you can talk about this in generalities. First of all, because I don't have the competence and expertise – to speak about the natural sciences, my intuition is these sorts of issues barely arise in the natural sciences, if for no other reason than they're intellectually serious, which the humanities in large part are not. Within the humanities, there are areas which are dominated now by political correctness, and the result has been a catastrophe of gobbledygook jargon devoid of any intellectual content and unrelated to any serious intellectual enterprise. In a word, it's unreadable. And it's unreadable because it's incoherent. It's nonsense. It's gobbledygook. Unfortunately for these proponents of this garbage, the fields are dying. These fields, which I have in mind, they're dying. And so there are three reasons. My guess is probably within 10 or so years, anthropology, sociology, geography, all those fields will be collapsed into one they'll call it social science department, in which they'll have representatives of each of these so-called fields, but they will, for all intents and purposes, have ceased to exist. Now, there are three reasons, in my opinion, why that's the case. One is, obviously, you can't find jobs in these fields anymore. You come out with an anthropology degree. What do you do with it? Not much. You come out with a sociology degree. What do you do with it? Not much. You come out with a geography degree, the same. English, my guess is, will last. It's a kind of piety in our culture. There has to be an English department because this is an English-speaking country, so English will probably survive. Philosophy, the kinds of philosophy they teach at places where I last taught, DePaul, they will presumably die, because the notion of philosophy there was Heidegger, Nietzsche, and Foucault. They thought that was the philosophy. So that will die. But the more serious departments of philosophy, I think for the same reason as English will survive, because it's a pillar of Western civilization. The classical philosophy departments, and the ones that are becoming much more mathematical, they will survive. But otherwise, first of all, because of the straitened job market, these fields will disappear. Secondly, because tuition, and it's related to it, tuition is so high, student debt is so onerous, that students are not going to major in areas which are going to leave them with a big debt and no job. And the third reason, however, is a self-inflicted wound. The third reason is these fields are nonsense. If you ever look at, for example, a Duke University catalog, it's just really a sight to behold. It's pure garbage.
Like what kind of garbage are you thinking of?
Read the descriptions of their books.
Yeah, the thing I want to point out is that in my experience, now I went to a state school in Oregon. I went to Portland State University and a while ago. I'm in my 40s, and so it was in the 90s. But the philosophy department was not where I learned about Foucault or Nietzsche, and I never read Heidegger in university. That was those thinkers were mostly in the English department. Communication department.
Well, the English there's still a serious English literature. I'm not sure anymore. But if you notice in the BDS movement, most of the most prominent academics in BDS are English professors. I mean, these are people who have nothing to do with their time. They don't read books anymore. I mean, that's a bore. So they get involved in things like BDS. It's almost all English professors.
Zero Books is a kind of a continental philosophy imprint, although that's shifting a little bit. But that's part of what we do. And I have found that the submissions we get are more often coming from people who are English professors than they are from philosophy professors. I would say like 2-1.
Well, English and also anthropology. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these fields have just become crap, regrettably.
And do you think that the political correctness
comes out
of that?
Yes, in those fields there is a real problem with political correctness. But then you have to remember, even in the social sciences, there are entire fields which are completely dominated by the right. You know, take the most obvious example, economics. Mm-hmm. Very few leftist economists out there. So even the social sciences, it's incorrect to say that it's all political correctness. But in some fields, some subfields of the social sciences, I think it's a correct description. But they'll be gone. They'll be extinct pretty soon.
Just to clarify for me, you may have already said this, but what do you see as the connection between the shallowness of the intellectual pursuits and those in the social sciences and in philosophy departments and things that are what I'll call the continental side? What's the connection between that and the political correctness that comes along with it?
They happen to be. I'm sure there is an explanation which I haven't thought through, but those are the main sources of the political correctness on college campuses. You don't hear anyone in the natural sciences really being involved in movements like safe spaces and identity politics. They're just not into it. If you go into a college campus, it's the main precincts of these calls for political correctness and so forth. They tend to be certain subfields of the social sciences. So I don't consider them sciences. I prefer to call it social studies. And the subfields are the rhetoric department. Rhetoric is a denotation for an English professor who has never read a novel. He or she majors in rhetoric. Rhetoric department, sociology department, anthropology department, they're the main purveyors and proponents of this kind of political correctness.
So we've been talking for about 45 minutes, and I know that your time is valuable.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get off. I have got to get some work done here.
Okay, can I keep you for another few minutes about, because I wanted to ask you two more questions. One of them about Bertrand Russell, I wanted to kind of let people understand the real strength of your book, which I think is how you lay out some rather complicated issues around speech, very much from a liberal tradition, taking on Bertrand Russell's ideas and spelling out some difficulties and some of their strengths. So do you have a few minutes to talk about that still?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in your book, you discuss how Bertrand Russell defended extramural speech on the grounds that a professor... Hi, this is Doug Lane. I'm just jumping in here at the end to let you know that you can hear the rest of this interview this Saturday on the Inside Zero Books podcast. The Inside Zero Books podcast is for Zero Books Club members. So if you would like to hear the rest of this conversation, feel free to join up for the Zero Books Club today.